Okay, the meeting will come to order, and first on the agenda is 1412, Representative Demmert. Representative Demmert, I will move that House File 1412 be considered for possible inclusion in the committee report. And did you have any amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, there's an amendment. Mr. Chair, I didn't get a copy of the amendment. What it is, it's very straightforward. I visited with Ms. Baker about it. Because this bill was introduced last year, we had to change the dates. So I think it updates it to make it so that we're not talking about taxes that have already been done. Oh, thank you. Mr. Chair, I believe the amendment is in the packet to the members. And basically, it's right at the very end of the bill, page 2, line 22, 23, and 24. It just changes the years to make it so that it makes sense, because the bill was introduced last year, and obviously these are already levied. So. So I would move that amendment, or I guess, Mr. Chair, I'd ask you to move that amendment. It's the H1412A1.
If Representative Emma, we're not finding the amendment.
Mr. Chair, the original bill had this effective for taxes levied 05, payable 06, and we're changing that to taxes levied 06, payable 07, I believe.
It is. Are you trying to mess us up, Representative Emmer?
Just trying to make it be right.
Yeah. I think you did. We found the amendment. It's the 1412A1.
Yep.
And Representative Nelson will move the 1412A1 amendment, and this is to get the bill in the shape you'd like it.
Yes.
Okay. Any discussion for the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. To your bill, Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1412 is one of a number of bills we've had out there dealing with the issue of ag land taxation for the purposes of school finances, let's say. A number of years back, I think it was in 01, Mr. Chair, before my time, where ag land was removed from the tax base for purposes of operating levies. Defined for farmers would pay on their house, garage, and 1 acre for the purposes of operating levies to make it more equitable, more fair, if you will, for taxpayers within a district in supporting operating levies for their schools. House File 1412 essentially does the same thing except now for capital debt levies with school bond issues. We have, you know, in our state we've always had a history of changing tax rates and adjusting things to try to come up with fairness as we tax constituents that live in whatever districts we're talking about, whether city, state, federal, or school districts. And as time has gone on, as the valuation of ag land has outpaced valuations of other types of property due to speculations, due to other types of things, has greatly outpaced the rate effects of the taxation load on ag producers as opposed to commercial or homeowners. And the valuation increase does not give any benefit to the farmers in terms of income, in terms of ways to grow their business. It simply means it's an asset that's increased. But what it has done is it caused their costs to go up. It's time, Mr. Chair and members, to take another look at this. We have school districts out there that are having a difficult time passing referendums, trying to update facilities or build new facilities that are needed for kids. I serve in the K-12 Education Finance Committee, and we hear bills, we hear testimony all the time from school districts that are just struggling trying to get these passed. Stories of 80% of the cost of referendums being borne by 15-20% of the people living in a district due to these valuations. So, in essence, what my bill would do is update the statutes to make the debt service levy be the same as the operating levy and bring a sense of fairness back to the payment of these taxations within the district, whatever load that district has, and hopefully help some school districts get these things passed because of perceived fairness.
Mm-hmm.
I might add that what this essentially does, in a nutshell, is that it would increase, in some instances, there's another issue you have to deal with, and that's debt equalization. In some instances, this would increase debt equalization. It does have a cost to the state. There's a fiscal note that starting in 08, I think the fiscal note is roughly $3 million to the state, and it goes on from there. And that's because of the timing of when the levy could be done and versus the paying. But essentially what this does is increase some tax, property tax relief is what this would amount to in the 08 year. More importantly, I think it would allow districts to have an opportunity to pass let referendums and keep their facilities up to date for the kids in our schools. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take questions or defer to Representative Broad.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. Representative Broad, did you want to move your two bills that are very similar at the same time?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be the best way to set up the discussion. These essentially are a menu of bills. Some who will testify will like one bill more than others, but essentially our efforts here are done in concert to try to figure out the best way to get something moved forward this year, Mr. Chair. I think that it's well within our guides to do it.
Okay, would you like to make that motion?
I'll move House File 1413 and House File 1414 for consideration.
Representative Brad moves House Files 1413 and 1414 for consideration for inclusion in a committee report. Okay, so how would you like to proceed then?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'll just make a couple quick comments, and then what we'd really like to do is have you hear from people who have been significantly affected and who have strong interest in these bills. I think Representative Demmer set the stage very well on why we're here. We're here for fairness. We're here to deal with a sense of overburden on agricultural properties in terms of school bond referendum. And Mr. Chairman, with that, again, maybe I should back up a little bit and give you a 1413, let me just walk through the two other bills that we do have for discussion today. 1413 is essentially allowing a school district to have the option of using of doing the debt levy on basis of market value. 1414 is continuing to use net tax capacity for the purposes of levying the dollars for school capital referendum, but it changes the rate. And essentially the differences would be the rate for residential homestead would be at 1% and 1.25%. Homestead land would be at 0.14 as opposed to 0.55 under the current law. Agricultural non-homestead would be at 0.25 as opposed to 1.0 under the current law. Residential non-homestead would be equal to the current law. Apartments would be at 1.0 as opposed to 1.25 under the current law. Seasonal rec would be at 0.75 as opposed to 1.0 and 1.25 under current law. And commercial industrial would be at 1.25 and 1.5 as opposed to 1.5 and 2 under current law. So, Mr. Chairman, essentially what we're trying to do with 1414 is create a win-win for everybody, recognizing that we've got to help some of the overburdened agricultural properties, but also recognizing that we don't want to shift too much to the other property uses. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I would like to call up Mr. Dan Melkert and Dan Morris to talk to you a little bit about. They actually brought the bill and the idea to me about 4 years ago. So, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Brad, that would be fine. They'd like to come down.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Demmer.
If I could, while they're coming down, just add a little more perspective on this. In the Education Finance Committee, we've been talking about property taxation for school districts and the burden. And there's really two issues that we're dealing with when you back away and look at the macro. One is how much state aid versus local property tax burden do we have, and what's the relative amounts. The second issue is, of the amount that is local, who pays it? And these bills today pretty much deal with who pays it, although mine, 1412, just for some perspective, does actually deal a little bit with also how much state aid goes in. If that helps the members or not, but from a, more of a general perspective, that's what we're dealing with.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. And maybe Mr. Hines or Ms. Baker, whoever would like to do it, could you just kind of briefly describe how this shifts, because they are changing rates? Is that...
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, each one of them is doing things a little differently. House File 1412 is not really shifting anything locally because it's only computing a different tax base for the purposes of determining the state aid that goes to the district. So it would get districts with more ag value, more state aid, but it wouldn't shift the burden within the district. And then House File 1413 is the one that would allow them to levy the debt levy against referendum market value instead of net tax capacity. So that would shift tax away from farmland and onto homes, and also somewhat away from commercial industrial and onto homes, because there's a different relationship between commercial industrial and homes in the referendum market value base. House File 1414 is kind of in between those two levels of shifting. It moves some of the burden off of ag land compared to a net tax capacity, but not as much as referendum market value. And same with CI, it kind of goes halfway in between. But we have not tried to do any runs on these statewide, because for one, they're typically district options, so you'd have to make assumptions about which districts would even use them. Presumably they'd only be used in agricultural areas, would think so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rucavina.
Point of clarification, Mr. Hines, on 14, you said it shifts it off ag land, and who does it shift it onto there? Homes and businesses again, or just homes?
Representative Rucavina, it would shift it off of ag land onto homes, and really it would also shift it off of CI onto homes. Because the referendum market value, dollar of home value, is the same tax base as a dollar of commercial industrial value. I should add, too, that the House File 1414 that I think Representative Broad was referring to, and I am, is really a delete everything amendment that's still being copied.
Mr. Chairman.
Handed out now, and it has a bill summary also, which will have the table of the class rates on it.
Mr. Chairman, I did want to point out to the committee that we do have two school districts, actually, that we did provide a run to the committee. You should have copies just as examples as to how the shift would happen. Under the current law, under the referendum market value approach, and then under the 1414 approach, which is what I call kind of a hybrid approach. But it does show how the shifts react within different categories of property.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know later today Representative Johnson's got another bill trying to get at this exact same problem. She's doing it through changing the first tier valuation for ag. And I think these bills are good ideas. I think I think the farmers have made a really legitimate argument that they need relief here. I just want to be sure, no matter how the division report comes out, I'm assuming we'd have some relief in one of these proposals, but is it right to assume that other than these big ag areas, the cities that could use this option, it really wouldn't happen where you'd have a lot of CI, because the effect would be such a huge shift to the homes, you really wouldn't see the metro doing this. Is that right? I mean, it just seems that they would not opt to do it.
That would be the presumption, Lencheski, that you would not opt to do it there.
Okay. To your witness, could you state your name for the tape, please, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Morris. I'm a farmer down in Waterbury, Legion, Morristown area. That's our school district. And I'm just here to testify on what's happening to the ag land. In 2003 and 2004 and 2005, our estimated market values have just jumped tremendously. at 15 and 20%. Our limited market values are almost as high as what our estimated market values are right now. I'm also a township supervisor, and we're just getting ready for our board of reviews, and I just got a copy from our local assessor, and in the 2006 ag sales, we've got 36 ag sales that the state says we have to use, and of them 36 ag sales, 11 of them are over $9,000 an acre, and there's 9 of them that are under $4,000 is all, and the rest catch up in between there. Right now, our 100% CER is sitting at $6,884 an acre. Our pasture is sitting at $4,745 an acre. And our waste ground is sitting at $2,665 an acre. And in 2003, I was on a committee with the school district looking at building a new school. And at that time, anybody with 640 acres with an estimated market value of $2,500 an acre would have paid approximately $4,500 a year if this $23 million school would have passed. And now our estimated market value is 68 instead of 25. And so it's devastating to the ag land on what's happening here. And it's kind of a double whammy, because as estimated market values are climbing, the state changed homestead credits here quite a few years ago, and instead of homesteading 240 acres, now all we can homestead is 600,000, and so we're down to 80 acres in some cases, or 100 acres is all we can homestead now. And so it's just the assessor says it's just getting out of hand, and he doesn't know what else to do. We've got green acres in place, but it's still climbing that fast.
Okay, thank you. And did you want to talk, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Melkert. I also farm in the Morristown area. When we go and discuss passing the taxes on to people that live in town, I want to bring up a very interesting thought. When the property taxes was initially started, the value of the house in town was sitting maybe at $8,000 to $10,000 an acre. And to get taxed equal with a farmer, because their house out in the country was not worth the value of a house in town because of sewer and water and electricity and all that, they added in 80 acres or 120 acres to bring that value back up so that the people living in town and the people in the country would be on an equal share. And as Dan has pointed out, now this has completely changed, and we're sitting there when the bond issue was tried 3 years ago to go through with this $22.2 million. By the time a 640-acre piece of ground, whether it was owned or rented, because the rent, if you rented it, the tax would be passed on to the rental rate anyway. I had talked with Ellers and Associates, who had done the services for the school bonding issue, and had them prepare for me a 20-year dollar value for the extent of the bond. And they came up with $112,000 over that 20-year period. The people that live in town were at approximately 10% of that. So they were looking at a total over that 20 years of paying roughly $10,000 to $15,000. I guess that is the issue. When we asked if the property of the ag land was taken off of there at that time, what it would add to the houses in town, it did not turn out to be a whole lot. I think it was, as my memory serves me, like $150 to $300 a year. The taxes on the houses in town would go up, but you have to keep in mind that the property taxes on the houses out in the country are valued at such a high value compared to the people in town, even if you went with a house, garage, and 1 acre, that the people in the country would still be paying way more than the people in town. I thank you for my time.
Thank you. Do you have other testifiers, Representative Brad or Demmer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do have a list of testifiers, and if we could give them each just a couple minutes, we'll try to be quick, Mr. Chairman. They've come from long distances. Ken Kuttner from Stewart is here, and he would like to testify as well, and I believe, Mr. Chairman, he supports 1412.
Welcome to the committee, and I'd ask that you state your name for the record, please.
My name is Kenneth Kuttner. I'm from Stewart, Minnesota, and I farm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for allowing me to testify. I have several other constituents from our area with me, but in respect for your time, we won't all talk.
Well, we're happy to hear from you, sir, so go ahead.
We represent a small district just west of the metro area, McLeod West, in the Broughton and Stewart area, and we're just very concerned about education in rural Minnesota, because with our aging facilities and related curriculum cuts, and we have a really steep declining enrollment. Despite this fact, we're facing a $22 million building bond referendum. It's due up for vote on June 6th. It amounts to a 28% tax on my income. It'll take $15.60 an acre off growing an acre of corn. And Senator Dill's book that he put out on ag talked about the fact that there's $56 an acre margin in growing an acre of corn. That includes all the government payments. So this would take $15 out of that, and that would be 28%. How that extrapolates out for a farm family is probably more dramatic in our case than what the previous testifier said, but if you compare the equal income person and about $100,000 household income, compared that to that was on ag land, and compared that to our superintendent, to generate that kind of revenue, the tax burden would be $17,200 a year, compared to the tax on that same income for the superintendent living in an average house. Taking a 5% opportunity cost on money, the superintendent would have $77,000 in taxes paid after 30 years. My tax would be $1.2 million under present law. That's just unbelievable.
Is there something wrong with that? Or?
Well, I kind of think so. The problem with, especially on the ag side, we have no way of passing it along. I mean, there's just no means of doing that, and we bear the burden of the most of the land. I mean, there's the assumption that because you have property or you're farming a lot of acres, you have a lot of wealth. In fact, most of the land is heavily indebted, and the earning power on that is limited. But yet, you're taxed on the valuation of it. So there's not a relationship in the amount of profit you're operating.
I think the problem down here is if you have a lot of money, everybody wants to know where you got it, why you still have it, and why we don't have it. But continue with your testimony.
Okay. We absolutely believe in the necessity of educating our children with the best possible education, and we're more than willing to contribute our share to these school buildings, but it needs to be fair and equitable. We believe that removing the building bond taxes from ag land is creating a situation that's it's based on the value of the residence. And most people live in a residence that reflects their relative means of income. And it very much balances it out. Ag land really does not contribute children to schools unless they're hiding out in a field somewhere. I'm not aware of that. It makes more sense to use ag property taxes to support infrastructure than to do building bonds. It's kind of an analogy of doing this. If you had a group of 10 people going out to a restaurant and two of them are going to pay the bill, and I think they'd probably choose a quite a bit higher priced restaurant than what was originally intended. The valuation of the farmland has been changed due to things that are out of our control. The 1031 tax exchange laws and those things have increased values and have really distorted this issue. The other issue that comes to play with modern agriculture is a lot of some of our oldest fundamental values are being challenged, and that's taxation without representation. A lot of times farms are residents of a farm, live just outside the school district boundary, but most of their property lies inside of a district, and they don't even have a vote on that. In our case, these two towns are so small that neither one can support a grocery store, and yet they're proposing a $22 million building. And the reason for that is there's a minority paying for this project, and they've realized that that can be done. So there's a total disconnect to what can be done in reality for a school district, you know, because they're not, the tax burden is so unequal. The reason that most of the older folks that still own that farmland have moved to be closer to medical services and things like that, and they still own their ag land as their retirement plan. They're getting cash rent for that farm, and they have, that's their income. This kind of taxation to fund schools with would only be fair if, you know, 401ks and pension plans are also included.
I think you point out the problem with buying down property taxes. You know, as long as we're using somebody else's money to pay for our local services, why not add to them?
Yeah. So. The other issue that I have with a couple, the other bills, 1412, 1413 and 1414, that includes that local control issue. Sometimes local control, and I think we're a prime example of that, is not a good thing. There's not the responsibility of fiscal responsibility, because they can see who's paying the bill and attempt to do something that doesn't make sense, both from an educational standpoint. And also these uneven tax burdens are just really hard on the communities themselves, very divisive issues.
So, thank you.
Any other questions?
Did you have any questions for the witnesses? Do you have any other witnesses?
I do, Mr. Chairman. If we could have Dr. Mark Vizek and Mark Marson. They're going to give another, I think they actually more support 1414, but I'll let them speak for themselves. They're from Fergus Hall.
Okay, if you could state your name for the record, please, Doctor.
I'm Dr. Mark Vizek, Superintendent of Schools of Fergus Falls area. And I'll speak a little bit to the philosophical and the educational value of the pieces. Mark Mazin, our business manager, has been a 20-year or lifelong resident and 20-year business manager of the district, and he'll speak to the financial implications. Now, first of all, effective schools have three components. It's a three-legged stool: quality people, quality programs, and quality facilities. You know, we get thrown back at us quite a bit that, you know, a good teacher can teach in a cave. Well, unless that cave today has high-speed internet, we're in trouble. We know that facilities make a difference, the learning environment makes a difference. And today, just as parents want choices and options for their kids' education, our constituents, our electorate, want some choices and options on how we finance these capital investments. As I mentioned, we know today so much more about how kids learn and how teachers should be teaching, and we know that environment makes a difference. And the learning environment, the facilities, makes a tremendous impact on the learning process. We're about to embark on our third attempt at trying to renovate a facility in the last five years to renovate a facility. I was down here last week, and our estimate was about $13 to $15 million. That estimate today is up around 2023 because of some new things we've learned. So if we don't act fast, we're going to be up to $30-35 million. The facility piece, the options are difficult. We've got a large ag community that is pushing. If we look at the bills, the 14, 12, 13, and 14 all have an impact for us. If our school was in a metro, it wouldn't be open. It's atrocious. It's an embarrassment, the facility is. and we need some help in rectifying this. I believe that our students are at a significant disadvantage to most of the students around the state with better, higher quality facilities. I'll turn it over to Mark.
My name is Mark Maston. I'm the business manager of the Fergus Falls Schools. I think part of our problem that we've seen is partly sticker shock. The building that we currently have was built back in the 50s when it was $6 a square foot. Current estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 to $180 a square foot. And when you apply this on an agricultural community, it puts an unfair burden on them. In addition, the Fergus Falls is also a retirement community. We have a major hospital there, and it attracts a very large population of retirees from the ag community. Last statistics that I show that Fergus Falls has at least twice as many retired people age 65 and older than the rest of the state. All they have to hear is what's happening in the agricultural community, and their vote is set. Their alliance is very... to the agriculture community is very strong. So in looking at 1414, I think that's a good hybrid. I think the idea that removing the agricultural property from the rolls is good. You had testimony here last week on another issue of ours that we had brought, where the farmer said that he liked the project, he wanted the project, but he couldn't afford the project, so he worked hard to vote against it. And one of the options that he came up with is removing the agricultural property from the rolls. That part is good, but the other, taking that step further, is we're concerned then what happens to the residential. And 1414, I feel, addresses that best in our district.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? Representative Rivera.
Chair, to the gentleman from Fergus Falls, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but does Fergus Falls have a lot of lakes and that around there too, don't they?
On the outskirts, not within the school district, very few.
Okay. I was wondering how that would have affected you. But
No. Alexander's a different case. Okay. We do have lakes, but again, they're not within.
Not in your district, Bob.
Right.
Okay. Any other Representative Broad?
Mr. Chairman, we have one final testifier, Dr. Joel Whitehurst, who is the superintendent of schools at Waterville, Elysian, and Morristown.
Certainly. Superintendent, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape.
Sure. My name is Joel Whitehurst. I am superintendent of schools at Waterville, Legion, Morristown. I guess I was told to keep it to a minute or two, and I will, because what I have to say, it would be repeating what you've heard. I guess what I wanted to do was to explain a real-life situation that we're undergoing down in our district. We're a small school of approximately 1,000 students. We have facilities in all three communities, in Waterville, and Elysian, and Morristown. They are deteriorating. We did put a committee together 3 years ago to study the issue. And as the other people have mentioned, we put a $22.2 million bond out in front of the general public. Soundly defeated. 70% no, 30% yes. After that was over with, we thought, well, let's conduct a public opinion survey to see what the issues were. First question that we asked was, if you were superintendent of schools, what would you do? And 72% of the people who reside within our district said we would come back forward with another proposal. So that told us from the beginning that they knew that we do have issues with our facilities. The other part of it, of the survey that came out, was that we needed to take a look at how the taxation would affect the farmers. So we've been working on that through Representative Broad and Senator Neville for the last 3 years, or 2 years rather, trying to come forward with something that we feel will work. As a school district, our facilities are non-rehabable. We had a gentleman out by the name of John Ryberg last Monday. We toured our facilities. He's looked at cost estimates for renovation, and he's looked at the size acreages of the sites. He told us flat out that he would not allow us to renovate. He makes a recommendation to the Commissioner of Education. So our only option is to build a new K-12 facility somewhere other than land we don't even own yet. We need to provide education for the kids in our three communities, and I don't know how to do it unless we do something differently. The mantra the last 2 years up here has been, make it a local decision. I think as a school district, if we have the option, we should be able to decide locally how we want to tax the people, our residents in that area on this particular issue.
Thank you. Representative Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was notified that you do have two people on your list formally, and they are also here, and we'll try to keep that very short, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your time.
Okay. No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Joel.
If you could state your name for the tape, please, sir.
Thanks for the opportunity today. My name is Tom Huser. I'm a farmer and a business owner from Glencoe, which is about 50 miles west of the Twin Cities in the GSL, Glencoe Silver Lake School District. This is the first time I have ever testified here. Normally would avoid this type of speaking engagement, but the issue of ag land being taxed on bond issues for building new or remodeling old schools is a problem that needs to be addressed. Just as educational needs for our children have changed over the last 50 years, examples being need for larger classrooms to accommodate technology or additional classrooms for special needs kids, production agriculture has evolved also. We no longer can make a living on 160 acres, 20 cows, a couple of hogs, and a few chickens. Margins are such that we need to specialize. We need to have more acres or more cows to spread our costs and allow profit. A $10 an acre bond referendum back in 1965 would have cost a 160 acre farm $1,600 a year, probably a hardship at that time. The same $10 an acre bond today will cost me about $20,000 a year. A 25 year bond would be about $500,000. And I know that's not feasible. I run about 2,000 acres of corn and soybeans. I cash crop, no livestock. We specialize, but I would consider this an average farm. I own a small percentage of my land. 13 landlords, including my father, own the majority of the land. When taxes go up $10 an acre, my rent will also. Production agriculture bears the brunt of these tax dollars in this setup. We farmers have no other choice but to oppose bond issues. That in itself creates conflicts within communities. Instead of working together, putting all our school districts' resources toward the good of our kids and grandkids, lines are drawn in the sand. You're either for or against. You're either a payer or a non-payer. And when you have a close vote within a community, nobody wins. Bottom line is, we all have pride in our communities and want to support our schools. But farmers are 3% of the population. And if this decision is going to be made by the school board, they would still want the ag land to pay. In my opinion, the house, garage, and 1 acre, the same formula used in excess levy referendums, should be used on all bond referendums as well, allowing me to pay my share, feel the same tax burden as my neighbors, and be able to support future school district projects. This needs to be done legislatively. Do not pass this decision on to the school boards of this state. That will create a whole new set of conflicts. Take ag land taxation off of school bond issues because it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Randall Thalman. I'm from Plato, Minnesota. I'd like to thank Mr. Chairman and the committee members, and particularly Representative Demmer and Broad, for their concern in this issue. My little town of Plato is the first town outside the 7-county metro area on US 212 southwest of the Twin Cities. My son, Brian, and I operate a crop farm and a seed conditioning business south of Plato, and I served on the Glencoe School Board from 1983 to 1989. We are in strong support of House File 1412 that will limit school capital improvement bonding levies to the farmstead, house, and 1 acre, and remove all school levies from the farmland. All farmers are willing to pay their fair share of taxes when the taxes are comparable to other residents of the school district, but a huge problem arises when farmers are required to pay taxes that are sometimes 10 times greater than the other residents. My son and I own half of the land that we operate, but any increase in the real estate taxes will fall on the land rent, and you've heard that several times. We also firmly believe that this needs to be a statewide mandate, because putting this decision in the hands of the local school boards would create and cause irreparable damage for sometimes generations to come. I have no concern that I support the House File 1413 and 1414 in that whole concept, except for the school board levy. I was on the school board. You don't want to put it in their hands, believe me. And on that note, if something like this would come to pass, the first and the most immediate thing that would happen is you would stop this huge, huge cavern discrepancy between the farmers and some of the city people. And I know that there's teachers in the room, but I went to school in the district where I was a school board member in the early 60s, and even then, in the classroom, we heard derogatory comments about the farmers because they weren't willing to pay their taxes. We heard it in the schoolroom. We heard it the outside. We're still hearing it these days. I get calls now that this is still going on in the classroom as we speak.
Let's see how derogatory they'd be after lunch.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
the farmers in our school district were a lot bigger than us, and if you made derogatory comments, they kicked the heck out of you. So we didn't make up.
If you say it in our presence, we can take care of it. Okay. The question, and there's a handout that has gone to you, so I won't have to go through it all. But farmers are willing to pay their share. It's the discrepancies that we have. The last part of my comments, the question I would have for you is education benefits people, so why aren't people the main source of revenue for schools? Simple question. In some cases, a retired farmer's main source of retirement income is his farmland, but the farmland is taxed for school bonds. Would it not be more fair to also levy for school bonds on the rest of society's retirement pension accounts, IRAs? I don't believe there's a legislature that would even consider recommending that. But we've been doing it to the farmers for 157 years. That's an old law. Part of my comments take a quotation where the farm law, the property law concerning farmland, is 9 years older than the state of Minnesota. It was the territorial legislature that created the property tax, and that law is 157 years old, and times have changed. I also state that it's more, it would seem that if people that had the benefit of a better education now have a better income, they ought to be willing to pay more. I like to thank you all for listening, and again to the representatives for helping us. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Representative Brad?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. That concludes our testimony. I will just note that we're going to be dealing with this one way or the other. I think this is a fair approach. I think this is a reasonable approach, and that's kind of why we brought you forward this menu. Just to note, when I say we're going to be dealing with this in one way or the other, a school district has come to the state for a bonding request to deal with some of the issues. They can't get a referendum passed or a school passed in their district, so they're coming to the state for help. If we do that, we're going to be doing that over and over again. This is, in my mind, a much better approach to give them the tools that they need to get some of these things passed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Mark Ford, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the discussion this morning. Appreciate Representative Denver and Representative Broad for bringing this forward. There has to be some changes here, and there has to be some fairness. And I would support, you know, a shift of moving from ag land onto commercial and residential. I think that's the fair way to go. One concern I have, and it kind of dealt with when we did the referendum a few years back and took ag land off that, is that like in the district I represent, there's four school districts that have their ag base is 80% or higher, and their communities are 500 or less. In fact, one district, if you combine the two communities, it's about 300. So if you were to take all of that and displace it on the business, one or two business in that town in the homes, it would just
you couldn't do it. So my one fear is that with this, for some of those where you have real small ones with high egg base, you might not have an option either way. And one consideration for the authors here, and this is what we did with the referendum, is we had an egg replacement aid that actually backfilled the portion that the egg land would have taken in these districts. Campbell Tinta is an example. They would have never been able to pass their referendum because it would have been four or five times higher on the homeowners. But with this egg replacement aid, it took care of that and it offset and they were able to pass things. Now, some might argue, well, if you can't afford it, then maybe you shouldn't have a school district. My take on that is we should do everything we can as a state to try to preserve the school district, regardless of the size. Would you be amenable to something like this if you were to do some of this where you'd say, you know, if you've got a district with ag land of 60%, whatever that threshold, that there'd be some ag replacement aid so that it wouldn't shift too much? You know, some of them, they're not going to be much of a shift, but in some of those small ones with the high ag land, there'd be this huge shift. Is that something that might be something you'd consider a...
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, you bring up an interesting idea. You know, without getting the specifics of whether that particular one is good or not, I need to share that I've been getting lots of phone calls, and I'm sure Representative Broad has too, regarding this concept, House File 1412. It's very interesting because that's the one that's attached to my name when I get the call. It's most of the calls that I get support the concept. Very interestingly, I get a lot of people that call me, and probably the majority, that say, you know, it's not that we don't want to pay tax. It's not that we don't want to pay our share. In fact, I even had another constituent, it actually wasn't a constituent, somebody from Greater Minnesota, call me and suggest that maybe we look at the concept of a building site as opposed to house, garage, 1 acre, which I'm going to explore a little bit. I think the point is, Representative Marquardt, you're absolutely right. It's not a question of whether we do something. It's what flavor, how we do this, so that there is perceived equity. That's why we have the menu. We are very sensitive to commercial taxes being paid as well as homestead and homes, because we all have homes. We all have, some of us have businesses, and so we're very sensitive to that also. That's why we're looking at these different options and basically raising the awareness so we can get down to a point of putting a package together that makes sense and is perceived to be at least as fair as we can be with everybody. So thank you.
Okay. Representative Rukavina?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer and Broad, you know, I certainly sympathize with you and with your farm constituents that are here. You know, up on the Iron Range, we don't have much agricultural land. We actually have a couple of very, very good dairy farmers that are still up there, but and some cattle farmers, not many. But we farm rocks called taconite, which is iron ore, and then we farm trees. And we're seeing the same problems you're seeing, but, you know, the problem I have with you, let's say up on the Iron Range, one of our only assets, our biggest industry doesn't pay a property tax. They pay a production tax in lieu of property taxes that gets distributed to old mining areas, and when we have an excess levy, they don't pay anything. So the other day, yesterday as a matter of fact, members, Mesabi East, which is the old Bowabic School District that consolidated with the Aurora Hoyt Lake School District, which lost their taconite plant, 1,400 jobs just 3 years ago, and has probably a mean age of, or median age of about 50-some years old, they passed an $18.4 million building referendum. I don't know, I mean, what kind of a burden it's going to be put, and they'll get some money from the state, and we did get some taconite money that we diverted, about $3.4 million of taconite money to buy that down to $15.2 million on the homeowners. But this problem is much bigger. You know, I noticed in here that you passed this bill out of Education Committee last year, and the problem is that you passed it out, but Representative Sikora didn't give you any money to fund it. Now, I don't know how shifting... I'm assuming a lot of those homeowners in your districts are old farmers, that retired farmers that might have moved to town and bought a home and sold their farm. So shifting to them, I don't understand how that could be fair either. Maybe it's less. I want to help these farmers. I don't know how circuit breakers work on agricultural land or what kind of help it would give them
Mr. Hines, probably not much. You're shaking your head. But the fact of the matter is that we haven't kept up to funding education in this state. We haven't kept up to funding for cities and that and local government aid, and everything's being shifted onto the property taxpayers. And it's sad. It's wrong. It's, you know, we gave multimillionaires, and if your farmer friends think I'm BSing them, let me tell out the run
that I got. Your notes out. Are you representing?
That run that I got from Ms. Manzi, who isn't here, but I asked, you know, give me the 50 richest Minnesotan income taxpayers in the state. Well, they couldn't give me 50 because they figured I might figure it's Carl Pohlad and Glenn Taylor and figure out who it was. So they gave me 55 in 2002, 58 in 2003, 57 in 2004, and last year, 55. To you farmers up there, these 55 people had an adjusted gross income. Now, remember, adjusted gross income is after they hire that Philadelphia attorney who writes everything they can off. An adjusted gross income of $1.702 billion. 55 people earn $1.702 billion in Minnesota, and we gave them $10 million a year in income tax cuts because they can't pay their electric bill. And we, every year, give them that break, and instead we've shifted taxes onto you, and we got fees and fines and everything else, and that's the problem, Representatives Broads and Demmer, that you got to address. Because I don't think if you tinker here and there, you're still going to help these farmers out, and you're certainly not going to help those old farmers that are living in those homes in your communities. So that's my comment. I don't know how we do it, but these farmers are smart enough to know, because they live it every day, that if you spend money somewhere else, you got to cut on your budget in another place. And if we spend money on them, we got to cut somewhere else.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if we want to get into an entire education finance debate over the formula or things like that, but in the bottom line is that since 2002, we've had a 21% increase in revenue. School property tax levies are now $300 million less than they were in 2002. And furthermore, we rank only second to Hawaii in the amount of state to local in terms of our commitment to education. We have a strong commitment to education. But, Mr. Chairman, our bills really aren't intended to deal with the education finance system of how much. We're talking about how fair. Even if we increase the how much, there's still a sense of unfairness and overburden for agricultural property. So our bills are really intended to address, and we can do that this year because the two of the bills don't actually cost money, which is why they're able to move forward. They're intended to address how much, how the levy is spread within the communities, and that's what we're here to talk about today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Limczewski.
Thank you, Chairman Vandeveer. And I appreciate that comment. Because I do think, you know, as I said earlier, you're trying to solve a problem. It's a real problem, and something does need to be done. But I do think it's interesting, and Representative Rukin and I have been talking before. He pulled out his filing cabinet. You know, he's got the filing cabinet.
Well, he scares us,
but,
Representative.
You know, it is a concern, though, that all these bills were heard, and I found interestingly passed without recommendation to taxes. I mean, it does seem like it is a school aid problem. I think you say to that in your initial comments, and I see the frustration. You're stuck. But it is a school aid problem. It's unfortunate that the Education Finance Committee hasn't found a way to change the formulas across the state so that this doesn't happen. But I respect that you're in a tough situation now, and you're just looking for a solution. Again, you know, Representative Johnson has another way of looking, and I do think we do need to do something, but I think this thing should have been fixed in education, personally, but it's not going to be. I mean, I see that now, so, you know, we need to do something.
How's it usually?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Well, again, I'm going to reiterate something I said earlier. There's kind of two different broad issues. One is the relative amount of school revenue that comes from the state versus local. That's one issue. As Representative Broad said, we are the second best in the nation in terms of the amount of state aid versus local property tax. 80% of our funding for schools comes from the state, 20% from local. It's only one state in the union that has a higher percentage of state aid, and that's Hawaii. That's one issue. But yes, we do have to deal with that. 21% increase in revenues to schools since 2002 with a $300 million decrease in local property taxes. That tells you the money is, the state is stepping up and doing some things. We can talk about school finance all day, but I'll let that go at that. Again, what we're talking about is that issue, how much state aid versus local. But really what we're talking about today is of the local burden, whatever it is, who's paying it locally? That's what we're talking about. And we're redistributing a given amount between residents of a given district to bring fairness. And I think with fairness, people can come together and get things done.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience care to testify for or against House File 1412, 1413, and 1414? And we are going to wrap this bill up in 2 minutes. So,
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Renee Hasbargen with the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and I will be very, very brief. The one thing that's missing from our discussion today is how we will fix the problem. And there is a partnership between the state and local school districts right now in the Debt Service Equalization Program. That's where the partnership that buys down the cost for the local taxpayers is, and there are a number of bills this year trying to address that problem. But let me just say that if we don't address debt service this year, next year the state share of that formula will be 2%. So we really don't have equalization when it comes to building school buildings in the state at all anymore. The second point I'd like to make, and you've had a long discussion about, so who is going to pay so that the students everywhere in Minnesota can have access to a quality building? Who is going to pay? And as Representative Dimmer pointed out, the state can pay more than the 2% they're going to pay next year. And his bill does do that. But I would caution you, and this is to Representative Marquardt's point, that more than 128 school districts in the state have more than half of their tax base in ag land. 128 school districts have more than half in ag land. And so to the point of this is going to cost something if you create this kind of hole, believe me, it is. And we urge you to use a statewide solution as you find solutions. And then finally, to the point that Representative Lincheski made earlier about it really depends on the mix of property in your district. When we try to shift to other properties paying the tax, that is indeed the case, whether it's the operating levy or the building bond. And we think it's terribly unfair that districts that have a lot of high-valued CI property or high-valued cabins or high-valued whatever have the option of shifting when those property poor districts, like many of the ones you're considering today, don't have any option to shift at all. So thank you for your attention to the problem. It does need to be solved, but it needs to be solved in K-12 as well as in taxes.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, part of the solution is what I consider an abuse by school boards. And the abuse by school boards is by holding capital elections at very strange dates. In 2001, I'm not going to pick on anybody's district but my own, the Hopkins School Board placed at the same meeting on the ballot two questions. One for a November ballot dealing with excess operating levy, because we require as a legislature for those elections, except those districts with statutory operating debt, to have a general election question. And at the same school board meeting, they put on board a $56 million capital election to be held the first Tuesday after the first Monday in December. I was involved in the uniform election date debate with former Representative Ostroff and former Representative Scheid. And the School Board Association said, well, you can't do this to us. You can't have uniform dates for these bond elections, because if you do that, we're not going to be able to take advantage of the changes of interest rates. We have to be nimble here. And I've been involved in the public finance area in the legislature for a long time, and I agree that you do have to be nimble. But I would hope that if we're going to really have a solution, that we limit the number of dates upon which these elections can be held to maybe 3 or 4 during the year, definable dates for an election for these purposes. Because one of the reasons that these large referenda pass in the so-called property-rich districts is that the school boards have the elections literally by invitation only. I don't know about any of your constituents, but my constituents don't wake up the first Tuesday in December and say, gee, it's election day, I better get to the polls. So I agree that there is a problem here, but part of the solution is for the School Board Association and others to not fight proposals for uniform election dates, but ask what is the system that we can put in place that works for everybody. Not just the rural areas in which you have some anomalies, not anomalies, but some bad results as to agricultural land, but also so that suburban and urban voters actually get their voice heard, and there has to be that connection between the school district and the voters.
Thank you. We have one more.
I'll keep this brief, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kirk Simon, staff of the Minnesota School Boards Association, and Brene is, rather than piggybacking on a number of issues that she has said, we also believe that there needs to be a solution to this, and the issue of fairness, equity, and equitable education are all important issues, and I think one of the important things that is kind of getting glossed over here, and Representative Demmer has touched on that, is the debt service equalization part, and since 1995, we've seen a significant decrease from 11% down to 3%, thus putting a greater pressure on your local residents to fund bond issues and capital projects. So we understand that this has a ways to go, and the debate will continue, but we need to seriously look at the debt service issue going forward.
And we will do that. In fact, we'll try and have we'll certainly have more committee time on this.
Well, Mr. Chair,
look forward to your comments.
If I could, before Representative Broad and Demmer leave, Ms. Hargarten, she brought up a good point, and that is the fact that for operating levies, the cabins aren't on it anymore. And in our districts, in my district, and so the farmers know what she was referring to, a few years back we said cabin owners don't have to pay for schools for operating. We pass an excess levy for our classrooms and curriculum, they don't have to pay. They got put on a statewide tax that gets distributed to everybody, and it's actually increased their property taxes, but it really isn't fair, and it's the same situation that you two are referring to. I only have home. I have nobody to tax. 60% of the land in St. Louis County, the largest county, the third largest county east of the school district, where you could fit the 7-county metro area and probably the St. Cloud to Rochester in it, 64% of our land is publicly owned. We can't tax them. There's wolves and moose and bear, and they don't pay taxes. So at least we haven't figured out a way, but us rangers could maybe figure that out after a while. But, so we have nobody to tax, and the cabin taxes were there, and now we can't tax them. And if you're going to move ahead with this, I'd like to work with you to let our school boards decide whether or not they want to tax the cabin owners. Now they argue, well, we don't live up there. And that's true. But, you know, as I said in this committee years ago when they did this, they should pay for an excess levy so that guy in the ambulance can read the defibrillator instructions when they're having a heart attack. And they benefit, as all society does, from educating people. And it's the same situation. Our only property wealth, really, other than those huge mines that don't pay these taxes, is the cabin owner. And the homes aren't really worth much, and they don't raise much money, so it's similar.
Representative Rukavina, that is heart-wrenching. Someone with your political persuasion and no one to tax in your district.
Yeah, except my mother and my aunt, who are already taxed.
Yes. Representative Brad.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Rukavina, I saw Representative Emmer had the other day a bottle of water that said Auntie Mabel, and maybe Auntie Virginia or Auntie, help
Gloria.
Me out.
Gloria.
Yeah. Could provide a water label for that, and she could maybe make some money to pay some of the taxes through that. But
she's on her fourth hip surgery. I mean, now you're going to put her to work.
Mr. Chairman, just a note, 1414 does deal with cabin taxes, and it does not take them off. I'm sure Representative Rukavina can find a way to tax the moose and the wolves. But, Mr. Chairman, we'd like to move forward with these bills.
Thank you. Representative Nelson had a quick comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representatives Broad and Demmer, and to your testifiers that are wanting to not tax this ag land, and they kind of like this house, garage, and 1 acre philosophy. As I look at your charts, you're shifting it around. You shift quite a bit onto CI. Those people, as you know, that own those businesses probably own a house, and so they're paying some taxes on that. And they get to vote as a resident. If they own a business, there's no votes there. If they enlarge their business, they improve their business, their taxes are going to go up on every issue. I think that, in fairness, tillable land is not something that should be taxed. I agree with that. But I do think, in fairness, that you have to look at an improved agricultural facility a lot more than a house, garage, and 1 acre. You have a lot of other buildings, et cetera. And we have programs that are giving even dairy credits. We're looking at a bill for that to even enlarge your business even more. I think every business in a free world would like to get some of those things. And so there has to be some thought to pay back. Just keep that in mind when you're working on the changes. Thank you.
Final comments.
Well, we thank you very much. I think it's been some good, strong discussion, and we look forward to continuing to work on this, recognizing the balance that we're trying to strike and the shifts that will occur and the requirements of local or options or not. So we'll continue working on it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just echo Representative Broad's comments. Appreciate all the comments you've had, Representative Rukavina. Anybody who's got thoughts, ideas, it's great. We've taken most of these things into account as we think about that. Representative Nelson's comments, right on. We understand. Thank you for the time. We're interested in any other thoughts, ideas people have.
And thank you for bringing the issue before us. With that, the Chair will lay over House File 1412, House File 1413, and House File 1414 for possible inclusion in the committee report.
So now, members, we're going to move to House File 3766, Representative Vanderveer's. And Representative Vanderveer has an A1 amendment, too. You want to move your own bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'd move House File 3766 for consideration for possible inclusion in the committee report. I do have an amendment.
No.
Two amendments, Mr. Chair.
Which one first, Representative Vanderveer?
I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And these two are to get the bill in the shape that I'd like it in. The A1 amendment requires some publication and public hearing information.
Thank you. Okay, any discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Amendment is adopted. To your A2 amendment, Representative Vanderveer.
The A2 amendment just clarifies the class that a property would, the class would be used for determining the tax on the property.
Discussion on the A2 amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. That amendment amendment is adopted. Representative Vandeveer, to the bill as you've got it straightened out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3766 is intended to provide, number one, some shine some light on the land sale activities of certain nonprofits when land is donated to them and they later dispose of it. And it also deals with the public hearing process or publication process as to the activities of in the land sales by these entities. Keep in mind that the, and if you look at who's affected by the bill, it is primarily intended to affect hospitals. They are, as you know, considered charitable and as such do not pay property taxes. And I think when you're receiving that kind of a subsidy from the people of Minnesota, you also don't pay income tax, you are exempt from all taxes. I think that some scrutiny is certainly appropriate. And we have some testifiers, Mr. Chair, that can give us kind of some examples of why this could be important.
Okay. Testifiers.
I think the first one is Dick Cheetah from...
I see you've got an effective date on transfers after March 1st of 06. Is there any way that we can make this retroactive to about March 1st of 2000? We had a similar situation.
Representative Nelson, I'm not sure, you might want to consult with staff to see if...
Starting with the Attorney General. Mr. Cheetah, identify yourself for the tape and proceed, please.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Dick Cheetah. I'm from Forest Lake. We've had an issue, and I think we brought it up with Representative Vandeveer. And it has to deal with the nonprofit. Everyone knows that the nonprofits are exactly that and don't participate in the tax revenue side of addressing issues of the common nature, whether it's school district, municipality, or whatever. What we've seen now, and an example of this, and it happened to be the local hospital, that the hospital was originally funded with individual contributions that go back to 1960, and those contributions in today's dollars are over $1 million. The ad valorem tax that came about over that same period of time was another couple of $1 million. The current asset value of the property is over $7 million, and the individual corporation that purchased this under a lease purchase agreement bought it for $1. Obviously, the taxpayer had to pick up the share of the burden that would have normally been put on by the institution that is tax exempt. Now, after a period of time and buying the property and through the process, They took on another 110 acres of tax-exempt in the community next to us, meaning that not only do you have $7 million in tax contributions and asset value, but you have another community that's going to be subjected to the same thing. At this time, the owner of the property went through the process of sale of the property, and guess what? We had a sweetheart deal. They sold it for $1 million to an organization that also has been involved with them in the developmental process. So who's the big loser in this process? After everything is on the table, the taxpayer lost their money. They lost the contribution to the tax. They lost the return on investment. They lost the asset value. And I think that this bill that Representative Vandeveer has brought forth will equalize
let's put it on as the previous people, but let's equalize and have everyone on the same class. If you have a piece of property, highest and best value, that's what the tax assessor tells you when you go in and you argue the point of value. And so if a nonprofit is going to sell a piece of property in a sweetheart deal, if I sold to my brother, it's not an arm's length transaction. If a nonprofit sells to another arm within their institution or a friendly buyer, it's not an arm's length transaction. And so when you look at it, the assessed value of property should be valued on the same level by all entities. If you're going to call it commercial, if you're going to call it industrial, if you're going to call it residential, we all know that there's rates associated with this, but let's level the playing field and let's put this back into a position that if you accepted the money and stripped the public of their tax dollar, stripped them of their assets, that you will then be forced to at least remunerate some of this over a period of time at the time of sale. I think that is addressed here. I think it's a good a way of starting this. I haven't had the opportunity to look at the two amendments that Representative Vandeveer brought forth, but I think that with the discussion that we've had on this, he's addressed the issues of the highest best use, the fairness, the equity, and that nonprofits should not be allowed to profit on ventures, especially outside of the scope of their obligation. We're finding that they're becoming real estate magnets. They're doing things that are outside of the scope that they were originally sent on. And with this bill, I think it will help a lot. We had a lot of controversy on this issue. It was a very high visibility in the community. The community was extremely upset when the property, and especially the gifting of this property originally by the landowners under a perpetual agreement, was denied. So if you look at a piece of property, whether you're a farmer or whether you are a landowner, and you gift a piece of property for a specific purpose, that gifting should be honored. We gift and put land into trust with the DNR for the future of our communities and future children and generations. It'd be a sad day if the situation put a time restraint on that and said that it was only good for a certain period of time. I think that when you look at this, that the nonprofits should be held accountable. The sale of the property at the time, they should be there should be a method of retrieving a certain amount of tax obligation to reinforce the community for what they've taken out over the last 10, 20, 30 years. I thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vandeveer.
Okay, I do have another testifier, the Commissioner Stafford from Washington County.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Good morning. My name is Dick Stafford. I'm a county commissioner from Washington County. I was probably asked to comment today. This is my speech, by the way.
You've got very good eyes.
Probably because of my former life of 21 years as the dirty, rotten tax collector in Washington County, which was more politely known as the county auditor treasurer. And I've been a commissioner for 8 years now. I'd make this very brief. I've been asked to comment as to the administrative aspects of this bill. It works. It'll work. It's run it by our current tax people. It's a lot like the Green Acres Law, so there's plenty of precedent for this. We had a couple of questions on some of the technical aspects as to how we identify a transaction like this for tax purposes when it comes through, and some questions on the calculation rate and the years that would be taxed. You're blessed with a staff person like Karen Baker, who supplied me with all of those answers, and we're very comfortable that this is doable.
Representative Simpson.
Representative Vandiver, is this a statewide problem, or are we seeing it in just certain counties, or what's your take on it?
Representative Vandiver.
Well, Representative Simpson, the extent of the problem, I'm not certain. I know we do have two situations in Washington County where donated land was sold by the nonprofit.
Well, Representative Vandiver, Representative Simpson, what I think you have is small local hospital facilities that expanded through time are now being bought up by long term, but let's say larger conglomerate type of healthcare facilities. I know that that for this facility in Chisago City and the one in Rush City as well, and I believe the one in Forest Lake, that there was this wouldn't have been allowed originally under state statute, but back in the 1970s there was some legislation that was slipped through very quietly, and none of the people that were going to be impacted, meaning the local residents that were using these health care facilities, were made aware of it. They had no opportunity to protest something they didn't know was going to be happening to them. And if a person is very patient, time goes by, gets forgotten, and now they can legally go ahead and do this sleight of hand type of transaction. And I think that's the crux of a lot of what has happened. But Representative Vandiver, anything else that you'd like to
testify? Mr. Chair, I think part of that, you know, is correct. When you have a situation where the community has donated land, there's been significant contributions. But some of that can't be fixed. In this case, there were specific covenants that, because of the 30-year rule, no longer applied, and that restricted the use of the land because the people that donated it put it in there. It was believed, and whether it was true or not, it was never resolved in court. Those covenants were ignored by the a charitable organization, and the land was just sold for private development. But I do have two other testifiers who can. One is who will quickly with and maybe describe some of the
Representative Abrams.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandiver. In the past, I served on the board of the Minnesota Orchestra, and they acquired some property in Brooklyn's park in order to build a amphitheater. Similar to summer venues that other organizations have. Wasn't in Bloomington, Representative Winchester. After they had acquired the land, and they held it for 3 or 4 years, they went to the people who would fund the amphitheater and found that they wouldn't be able to raise sufficient funds in order to be able to put it to the desired use. So what the orchestra did with the land that they acquired, and they didn't pay property tax on because they are a 501c3, is that they sold it. You may have seen it in the paper that there's now some controversy that if they had held it for another year or two, they could have sold it for some more, but the orchestra was not in the landholding business. They did make some money on it, and guess what? They put it right back into the orchestra for 501c3 purposes. I understand your bill is a hospital bill, but what was wrong with that? They bought land, they acquired property for a charitable purpose dealing with the orchestra. They sold the land at a profit, put it to use for the same purposes. And yes, they didn't pay property taxes for 3 years, but they wouldn't have paid property taxes anyway. So what is the, why should that transaction lead to a taxation after the fact?
Representative Vandiver.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, it sounds like that situation is probably a little bit different. In this case, the land itself was donated by the community to the nonprofit for the with the idea and expressed in the covenants that it be a hospital or public use, and those that donated the land specifically stated that. Now, it sounds like in the Orchestra case that they purchased the land and then later resold it and made money. I don't believe that this would impact that transaction.
Okay.
Other questions? Can you testify? Please identify yourself for the tape. Proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Pichar. I live in Forest Lake. And I'm here to speak to the same issue that the previous testifiers have. I don't know the statewide applicability of this legislation, but I do know one case in point in Forest Lake that definitely applies. And just to give a brief review so you know what we're talking about, that happened in Forest Lake. Is between 1956 and 1960, the community needed a hospital. The doctor had five deliveries in his kitchen at his home in one evening, and he was driving Highway 61 to go to Anchor Hospital, and he needed something locally. And the community took it on as a challenge. They rallied, camaraderie, shoulder-to-shoulder work, style shows, car washes, the kids sold fudge in the stores. I gave you a handout that has that history in there, and you may want to peruse it when you get a chance. But they had a thermometer downtown, and the thermometer was at $250,000, and over 4 years they only could raise $115,000. And that in today's dollars is about $1,150,000. And they realized that their effort to build a hospital was going to fall short from local contributions. And they bought a piece of land in that period of time at a discounted value from a couple of farmers, Melvin and Violet Swanson, and they realized they weren't going to be able, through charity alone, to raise the money for the hospital, and they formed a hospital district, municipal corporation, political subdivision of the state, and it was known as the Memorial Hospital District. And it was comprised of six communities, and the charitable group gave the land to the hospital district for $1 and put covenants on the use of that land. The hospital district had the right to tax, and during the ensuing 48 years, levied $2.5 million worth of ad valorem taxes on all the property and the member communities. In the early 90s, when the hospitals were going under consolidations and mergers and acquisitions, the hospital district sublet the operation of the hospital to a nonprofit hospital corporation, and part of that sublet agreement gave that nonprofit hospital the right to buy the property at the end of the lease. Now, this was public land. It was owned, the fee title owner was a political subdivision, a state agency, a municipal corporation of Minnesota, Memorial Hospital District. And nowhere at any time were there any public hearings, was there any public debate about what the community might need or what the member communities of the Memorial Hospital District might need that would be useful, like an assisted living facility or a hospice, or our community needs a fire station. 16 of 17 churches in our community signed a statement that they would like to have a teen drug center there. No. The nonprofit that had the purchase option took the land and without advertising it, without listing it, without having it appraised, just entered into two sales agreements with two different entities to sell the land for approximately $1,100,000. Now, the land's on the county books at $7,150,000, $7 million and some change. And so none of the equity that the community had in it has been accounted for at all. The hospital, nonprofit hospital, got the hospital license, built a hospital someplace else. The license was free of charge to them. and then they made a sale at a fraction of what the value is on the county books. Now, I have no idea what the difference between the value on a county, the county assessor rolls is and what a real assessed value would be, but I think we can safely say it's somewhere in between the two. And so I think this bill, at least Subdivision 1, I haven't seen either amendments, would allow our community and our county to recapture some taxes that were lost, and so in that regard, I'm in support of the bill, and I know the Forest Lake Community Association, of which I'm a charter member, is supportive of the bill, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Vanderveer.
We have one other testifier who kind of put it in perspective of some of the issues that we're going to be looking at in the future with nonprofits and land.
Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony, sir.
I'm Dennis Hagberg. I'm a Washington County Commissioner, which serves the area of Forest Lake, but I also have served on the United Way boards since 1979. I've been in banking for 30 years. I've been in Chamber of Commerce and served on boards that would have to deal with difficult situations when we had to downsize, so to speak, in the business side, we'd say. But we'd have to dispose of our assets and we have to lay off some people as a nonprofit. So those issues are very difficult. But in this particular case, and I think in the cases in the future, we're going to see more of this, and we need to have some method of a political debate so those issues are brought to the public prior to the sale. I sit on the HRA board of Washington County, and by state law, we have to have a public hearing when we dispose of property. But it doesn't, in the state law, it doesn't tell us when. And that is a conflict, because we've talked about a little bit, because we've disposed of, we're working on a mobile home park now that we've owned for a number of years, that when the HRA was going through some periods of time that we're buying real estate like crazy, and we've spent the last 10 years trying to reorganize ourselves and get rid of that debt, but we have to dispose of some of the assets and change it to a different use. So we need a clarification. I think the public hearing should take place prior to the purchase agreement or at the time the property would be open for sale. We also are starting to see that as a county, we're giving donated or given tax forfeited land to nonprofits for housing purposes, which are worthy needs in the community for low-income housing. But at some point in time, in 30, 40, 50 years, those properties will have to be disposed of. And how do you do that? We have conservation easements and we have open land things that are coming forward as we are growing county, and we're buying that land is being donated to a nonprofit. And then at some points in time in the future, that land will maybe have to be used and disposed of in a different manner. So I think a public hearing would be appropriate and worthwhile. Going back to the three-year taxes, I think that is fair, because when you sell a piece of nonprofit taxes, it's not paying any taxes this year, probably not paying taxes the following year, and probably not paying taxes the next year, even though it's sold today, because of the way our tax real estate tax structures are done. So it would be assessed at a value and then in sometime in the future. This would back it up so that if a developer bought the land, he would also have to pay in the price or in the property the taxes at the point in time that he would probably be using it and starting to make it a different productive organization. I want to thank you for your time. I know you've had a busy morning and appreciate your comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Questions, comments? Representative Vanderveer, you want to wrap up your bill?
Okay. Thank you, members. I think that pretty much does it. I think the last testifier said is the case. This property has now been sold to a private developer, yet it'll be 3 years before it actually pays taxes. So this bill would capture some of that. But I think the real issue is that taxpayers have significant investment in these nonprofits. And not paying property taxes on $100 million facilities, I think, requires that we have some, some public input, some public process. In this bill, we went with publishing of the intent to dispose of this land, and it's pretty narrow in scope, and that it only deals with land donated with the expectation that it would be used for that purpose. So that I appreciate.
Okay, anybody in the audience for or against the wishes to testify on this? House File 3766. Seeing none, Representative Vandeveer, renew your motion.
And renew my motion that House File 3766 be laid over for consideration for possible inclusion in the committee report.
Thank you. Representative Dorman. House File 2883. Okay. Representative Dorman, proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 2883 is before you. I believe you should have, if you don't already have, an amendment that was prepared. I think Representative Seifert talked earlier and talked about supporting my bill. You, many members on the Ag Committee, may recall that when we were through the Ag Committee, there were several different approaches to this issue, and this seems to be the combined solution.
I guess probably first the chair will move House File 2883 for possible inclusion in the committee report, and then we're waiting on the amendment, I guess, Representative Dorman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to start explaining it if I'd be all right, or the council.
Okay. Go ahead. I think probably we got it now, and so you want the A2 amendment to put it the bill in order that you want it, right, Representative?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do.
And the chair will move the H2883A2 amendment. Any discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. That motion prevails 2-0. You got a great audience here, Representative Dorman.
Well, you
run away.
For last. Hopefully we can.
Well, you're not near last.
Pass this one. No one.
You're not near last. So.
And Dorman, I think we'll be able to get this without too much problem.
I'm hoping so. Mr. Chair and member, the bill before you takes a look at the first-tier homestead classification on agricultural land. As you may recall, in 1999, we made several changes to our tax codes, and we went from protecting 320 acres, the first 320 acres were homestead, and went to a dollar amount of $600,000. Since then, with the inflation, normal inflation, ag land inflation, for a variety of reasons, we're no longer protecting the same number of acres as we did in 1999. Last year in the House tax bill, we did have a provision that would bump that $600,000 to, I believe, $700,000 or $750,000. That did survive to conference committee, but we did not get that through. So I put the bill in again this year, Mr. Chair, and there are numerous members that have joined as co-authors on that, and it was first heard in the Ag Committee with some other ideas on how to get there. Should it be $1 million? Should it be $2 million? Should it go back to acres? The Assessors Association, and I think they're right, would prefer it not be on acres. Just adds a little more complication to their already complicated lives. But what does seem to make some sense is to try to figure out where we would be, add inflation to it, if we started at the base year of $600,000 in 1999. Mr. Hines worked with the Department of Revenue and determined that that provision currently would be at $970,000, and what this bill then would do would have an automatic inflation factor in there, so we don't have to keep coming back and readjusting this every few years. There would be a little bit of cost to the state in terms of increased property tax refund, because what this will do is it will shift within the taxing jurisdiction. So there's no, other than the PTR cost, there's no direct cost to the state. But I think it does keep that reform that was important in 99 whole. And, as values, I know, are rising on that ag land, and it's starting to get, you heard
several bills earlier with trying to pass excess levies and building referendums, as we all know, much more difficult. With that, Mr. Chair and Member, I'd be happy to stand for any testimony, but I believe there's a few people who do want to come down and testify on the bill as well.
Okay. Bring your testifiers down. Do you have any? Identify yourself for the tape, please, sir, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief, give you the Reader's Digest version. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm Director of Government Relations of the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we wanted to be on record as supporting the attempt to raise something with the $600,000 limit. I do represent farmers, and Representative Dorman, when he first proposed it, he put a press release out in AgriNews or something. It was interesting. The farmers have contacted me. And I was interested in looking at the Minnesota revenue sheet, and it says number of taxpayers affected, and it says primarily owners of large farms. And I would say that depends on where you are and everything. If you're in a regional center and you see where the price of land is going, you can have 200 acres in Blue Earth County at $5,000 an acre. I wouldn't call that a large farm, but I would call it an issue that we need to address. I also want to just be on record, too, of stating that our farmers are very concerned about what 1031 land exchange prices are doing out in the countryside. And the numbers I see that since 2001, there's been a 300% increase in those land transactions, and that the 1031 exchanges also make up about 30 to 40% of all the farmland transacted in southern Minnesota, and it can drive up land as much as 20%. So I appreciate Representative Dorman, Representative Johnson trying to offer solutions to this problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Chris Raddatz, Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau, and I will also be brief. We want to also be on record as supporting Representative Dorman's efforts here. We've worked with him last year on the issue, and again this year, and I think he's really got a good idea here where we index the issue. We also worked on it back in 99 when we went away from an acres to a dollar value, and as you can see, that dollar value, to give the same type of relief that was intended in 99, does need to be adjusted. We think he's come up with a good idea, kind of putting together some other proposals that were out there that Representative Magnus and Representative Seifert were carrying also. So we strongly encourage the support for this. It is a big issue for farmers. I think right now probably property taxes are really one of the most pressing issues that they have as far as dealing with state issues. So we'd appreciate the support and hopefully including this in the final committee report.
Do you have any other testifier, Representative Dorman?
None that I... Oh, wait a minute. I was wrong. Well, he's coming up. I would point out that, you know, this impacts every farmer in the state because it talks about those first acres. So whether you're small, medium, or large, you know, you're going to have that homestead. But the cap on it really, in most places, would drop out before you got 400 acres.
Proceed, sir. Identify yourself for the table.
Yes, I'm Robert Moe, the Otter Tail County Assessor. I'm here... I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We support the concept of using land value versus acreage in these type of issues. It does make our job a lot easier using a land value method instead of acres. Also, I'd like to thank Representative Dorman and Seifert for working along with us on this issue. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Representative Simpson.
How was the weather in Otter Tail County when you left this morning?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, I left yesterday, so I'm not sure what it is today.
Okay, thank you.
Do we have anybody in the audience that wishes to speak either for or against House File 2883? If not, the chair renews the motion that House File 2883, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dorman, House File 2884.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2884 takes a look at the special ag land homestead. We adjusted, I think, last year and added a few more people, and this would, Mr. Chair, add a few more. Currently in ag land, if the provision for the special ag land credit was originally going to be if you thought about mom and dad moving off the farm and going to town,
and then either still farming that land or maybe a son or daughter farming the land, still allowing the homestead credits. And we've made several changes to that. We've went, you know, son or daughter. I think last year it was grandson and granddaughter was last year. And what this would do would be to add brother or sister to the list. You know, it still has to meet the same provisions. You have to live within, I believe, is it four townships? Four townships of the farm, so, you know, you don't have somebody that's living in New York City or something and trying to get a homestead exemption. You know, still trying to keep that farm family together. You know, the cases that I know of in my area, if you think of the original family farm, you know, maybe mom and dad moved to town, one of the brothers still lives on the farm place, but as the farm gets split up into the next generation, you might have a son or daughter who still wants to stay connected to the farm, still wants to own that land, still lives in the community, and this bill would allow them to still get the advantage of that homestead credit. It still have to live within the four townships. Would have to be, I guess, the case that I know of, it's usually two brothers where one farms, the other one, for a variety of reasons, no longer farms, maybe went to work in town, but still wants to hold that land as long as he can, feels that affinity to the family farm. And so what it does is adds brothers and sisters to the already expanded list of who can qualify.
Representative Simpson.
Representative Dorman, I missed that clip. What did we pass last year? Didn't we, with Representative Westrom, didn't he have...
We added grandson and granddaughter.
Okay, thank you.
And my mistake, I probably should have offered an amendment or yeah, I think that even Representative Westrom thought this was already in there when I talked to him earlier about the bill, which is why you'll see he is the, you know, he's also on the bill with Representative Dammer, Heidrich, and Davids and others, so...
Anybody in the audience wish to testify either for or against House File 2884? Seeing none, the chair renews motion that House File 2884 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report. Thank you, Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member, and staff.
Representative Johnson. House File 2924. Representative Johnson, whenever you're ready, proceed. Oh, excuse me. I suppose we should move it first. Representative Marquardt moves House File 29, whatever that was, 2924, for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. You've heard a detailed and thoughtful discussion today of the need for both equity and adequacy in taxation and education policy statewide. I can do this in 30 seconds. I know we need to leave the room. Thank you very much. Oh, have we got some time? Thank you kindly.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll go with the chair on that particular ruling. But thank you for your attention to this very complex problem. We know that when we squeeze the balloon in one area, there will be a bulge on the opposite side. And the discussion over the inflating values of agricultural land and the impact that that has on debt service for our rural schools is extremely crucial to having high-quality education statewide. This bill is intended to be one more card on the table as you look at balancing the responsibilities of both equity and adequacy in tax and education policy. I'd be glad to answer any questions. This is a bill very similar to Representative Dorman's that takes the emphasis off of, first, as we did just several years ago, number of acres, moved it to valuation, but that has its own problem because of skyrocketing land values. House File 2924 moves that to a percentage increase in valuation. Just one more option as you consider all of the variables necessarily to crafting a good tax bill here. I appreciate very much your attention to this concern.
Any questions for Representative Johnson? Anybody in the audience wish to testify either for or against House File 2924? If not, Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 2924 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Marquardt. You have a pair of them. House File 3509. We'll let you move your own bill, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members, and I will move House File 3509 and 3510 for possible inclusion into the division report.
Proceed, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This, of course, addresses an issue that is probably, if not the top, one of the top issues, at least in my area and I think around the state, and that is increasing property taxes. And what these two bills do is it provides long-term direct property tax relief to every area of the state, and I think it's a balanced bill, both of them. What I'd like to do is just go over them both together, because there's actually only one part of the bills are different. So if you look at Section 3 of the bill, that deals with the same issue as Representative Scalzi's bill yesterday, and that restores the $16.5 million of market value homestead credit cuts to those 103 cities, and I don't think we need to probably...
You think we have enough discussion on that, Representative Mark?
Mr. Chair, I think we have thoroughly done that issue. We are well ready to vote on that area.
Thank you.
Section 2 of both bills are the same, so I'd like to go to Section 2, and that deals with the agricultural market value credit. And the sheet that was just passed out to you, page 1, I have plagiarized what the House Research has put out on agricultural market value credit, and then I just put in my own line on how it would now be impacted by 3509, 3510. And basically what it does is on the first $115,000 of value on ag land, it goes from 0.3% to 0.4%. So we're at $115,000, your maximum would be $345 right now. You can see on my line I drew in, it would now be $460 at the $115,000. And then it decreases at a rate of 0.5% to a maximum decrease of $115. So it goes down to $345 at $345,000 market value. So I calculated using Mr. Hines' 2006 property tax simulation and his effective tax rates, and he always warns us that these are only averages and they differ based on area and market value, but the effective tax rate on this would be about 0.48, and so on a $600,000 market value, the decrease would be about 4%. They'd get a property tax relief about 4%. And I took $1 million at a 0.48 effective tax rate, it'd be about 2.4% decrease at $115. So that's identical in both bills. So if we could move to 3509 first. Okay?
Go right ahead, Representative.
All right, thank you. And that's page 2. So Section 1 of both bills are a little different. Here's what they do, and they deal with homestead market value credit. One way, you know, we've talked about one of the goals this year is to provide direct property tax relief, and one of the best ways, I think, is to do that with homestead market value credit. What this bill does, 3509, increases the homestead market value credit from 0.4% to 0.5% up to a maximum, which is the current of $76,000 value. And yesterday we had an excellent kind of primer on this, so I think we all understand the homestead market value credit. What it would do at $76,000 value, your max right now is $304. That would raise the max to $380. And then it decreases at a little different rate than current law. Instead of at 0.09% of value, it decreases at 0.10. And so it would go down and it would max out at about $456,000 value. Now, what would that mean for property taxpayers using
Mr. Hines' effective tax rate of 0.108, with, again, the disclaimer that there's variations, but just using the average, on a $50,000 home, the savings of about $50 or about 9.3%. On a $100,000 home, the savings equates to about a 6.9%, $74. $200,000 home, $64, or 3% of the bill. And on a $400,000 home, about $44 savings, about 1% of the property tax bill. As you can see, the homestead market value credit is set up where the lower valued homes do get more of the benefit. And that, well, I think part of that was back in 2001 when they changed the classification rates and moved it from to 1.0 all the way up to like 500,000 valuation. They figured the rate break-off at that time, Mr. Hines, is that 76,000 where it went from 1.0 to 1 point? I can't remember. I was trying to look that up, and I knew you would know. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, it was at 76,000 before 2001 reform, but there was a the credit that we had at that time, which was the education homestead credit, was heavier on that low end, and it kind of, as I recall, about 125,000 kind of went to being not very significant. So there was sort of the added break of that.
Thank you. It follows along the same, I guess, theory that was used when that was done. If we could go to House File 3510, which is page 3. And again, I've put in the impact of that. And what this does is very much like Representative Johnson's bill, which recognizes the inflation kind of increase in market value. So if back in 2001 or 2002 it was 76,000, it just somewhat arbitrarily raises that, figuring that home now would be worth 85,000. So it just goes in line. Nothing else changes as far as the formula. It's still at 0.4%. It just now maxes out at 85,000 instead of 76,000. And the decline is the same at 0.09. So you max out at $340 at 85,000. It goes down and you bottom out at 462,000. Now, what does that mean? For a $50,000 home, there's no change. But in reality, there probably would be, because if you had a $50,000 home in 2001, more than likely it's worth more now, so you're going to see a benefit. But if it stayed the same, you would not see a benefit under this one. $100,000 home, actually all of them now above $76,000 would see about a $44 credit or savings roughly based upon. And so $100,000 would be about 4.1% decrease in taxes. $200,000 would be about 2%, and $400,000 would be 1% again. Just real quickly, Mr. Chair, if I could, you know, why this approach? I do believe this is just kind of one part of what we could talk about overall in property tax relief. This is kind of a direct relief. You could also have the local government aid increase. You could look at property tax refunds. I do think there's another side of things that we have to look at in accountability. On the truth and taxation process, you know, last year I had a couple bills. One was to move the time at which that TNT notice goes out from after the election to before. Even a one-stop shop type of thing where the county, the school could all. I mean, I think we need to do more on the accountability side too. So what I'm saying is this is just kind of one approach of many things you could probably do. I do think this, when we talk about direct property tax relief, and it wouldn't occur until payable 07, which is next year, but it is clean and it would be easily administered. It's within the system. And the third thing is, I actually, during the interim, was thinking of a rebate, and I talked with Mr. Hines and others about this. And, you know, that's one way to do it, a rebate. And the problem with a rebate, I mean, you could take that $317 million, which is one-time monies, and do a rebate or something. And, you know, it's just one-time money. It doesn't do anything permanently on property tax relief. But, you know, I started talking with folks back home about a rebate, which could come out as early as maybe this fall. And the comment I always received was, you know, last time you gave out a rebate, you went from a $2 billion surplus to a $4.5 billion deficit. Now, I know that wasn't, you know, the cause, but that's the perception. And then they said, when would it come out? I said, well, about this fall. Oh, sure, election time.
So there's a real skepticism about that. And I actually, if you want to see it, I had a format to do a rebate, and it was shelved after talking with folks. So this is permanent relief, and in for consideration on a mix of many things that might come up, but I appreciate the committee.
Well, I think certainly, Representative Marquardt, just my own opinion, that changing policy and making things permanent, that's something that people can, with the explanation, they can understand. But I think that my experience with that skepticism, and while we had nothing to do with that rebate, I didn't see anybody that really fell in love with it, even right from the get-go. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to that point, too, I think long-term tax policy is better than and doing the rebate. And I think you're absolutely right, Representative Marquardt. Talking to people in my district, I got the same type of feedback. And I think we need to do something that has long-term effect. So appreciate your work on this.
Anybody in the audience wish to testify either for or against House Files 3509 or 3510? Seeing none. Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 3509 and House File 3510 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee report. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. It was nice that you had two bills, so you came back and... Because Representative Simpson and I could have really raised heck with Representative Vandeveer's committee.
I held all my amendments back because I do believe.
And we have one order of business, and Representative Marquardt, as reward for coming back and keeping his company, will move the minutes of the April 5th meeting. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Minutes are adopted. And I think that's all the business that we have. We are adjourned.